President Trump made building a massive wall on the border with Mexico a major focus of his campaign. But the barrier, sometimes wall, sometimes fence, sometimes not much of anything, has perplexed and confounded people since there's been a border to mark. Our guest this hour put some deep thoughts into the border wall, even before there was a Trump campaign. Ronald Rael is an architect, artist, and activist. He collects his wall ideas and those of other contributors in the book Border Wall as Architecture, subtitled A Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. Ronald Rael holds positions in two departments at the University of California, Berkeley, the Department of Architecture and the Department of Art Practice. He is also the first name at the architectural design studio Rael Sanfratello with Virginia Sanfratello. Ronald's last book was Earth Architecture, about building with our most abundant material. Ronald, thanks for joining us on The Exchange today.
Thank you for having me, Jeff.
It's a compliment that you're very hard to describe, architecture, art, and activism all combined in here. But how do you describe what you do?
Oh, I guess, well, I'm an educator, I'm a designer, and I like to think about maybe the topics that architects usually don't think about too much, like borders, like building with mud, these kinds of issues.
So to push the envelope a little bit on just the standard, you know, we're going to use the glass and carbon steel and that sort of thing.
Right. Well, I like those too, but, we work with 3D printing, with strange materials like salt. I think there's just different venues to explore in design, and I've been excited by that.
You build with salt? I'm going to hear about that one.
Sure. Well, we do a lot of experiments with 3D printing, and we wondered what other materials you could 3D print with. And so we harvested some salt from the San Francisco Bay, and we converted it into a 3D printable material, and we made what we call a salty glue, because it's made out of salt and glue.
Wow. And what have you printed with it?
Well, we made this structure that you could actually occupy. So it's about a 6.5 foot tall igloo, but instead of snow, it's made out of salt. We've made some other experiments with recycled coffee, with recycled grape skins from Sonoma. So we're looking at ways to make architectural building components with different kinds of materials.
Yeah, I really do encourage people to take a look at the various web pages that you occupy, because there's lots of interesting things to look at there. And it's fair to say there's nothing quite like this book. What did you set out to do here?
Well, I was interested in what was happening along the border. I was spending a lot of time along the border in the early 2000s. We were working on a project called Prada Marfa, right outside of Marfa, which is also a strange project. I don't know if you've seen it. But
I did, yeah.
Yeah, it was a collaboration with two artists from Berlin, Elm Green and Dragset, and it's a faux Prada store in the middle of the desert on your way to Marfa. So alongside this very lonely, desolate road is what looks like a Prada store that holds the 2004 line of purses and shoes, but you can't go in. It's hermetically sealed. It's not a store. It's more a commentary on the juxtapositions between wealth and poverty, between the United States and Mexico, between traditional materials and contemporary materials. So we designed it to be built out of adobe, and it's made out of adobe, but it also has large glass storefronts, and it has this very expensive shoes and purses inside of it.
Yeah, it's also worth taking a look at those pictures. Maybe we'll provide a link to some of those on our Facebook page. But this Prada store sitting in the middle of the desert near Marfa, Texas, which is sort of like a little mini Austin, about 4 hours west of Austin, and it's just sort of jarring to see it out there in the landscape. So you get an idea of where Ronald's coming from with this kind of stuff. So lest anyone think that this book, Border Wall as Architecture, was rushed to press. I mean, you have been thinking and talking about the border wall pretty much since you lived in that region, it sounds like.
Yes, when we were working on Prada Marfa, the day we showed up at the building site to plan for it, we were surrounded by Border Patrol agents. So I quickly became aware of the kind of police state that exists along the border, and how you're constantly being watched. There are aerostat blimps overhead. And while we were constructing it, we'd often see helicopters pick up people wandering and migrating in the middle of the desert, probably, you know, walking for several hundred miles in the dry, hot desert. It gets up to 120 degrees there sometimes in the summer. And we also saw the introduction and the beginning of the construction of the wall, especially around after 2006, after the Secure Fence Act was passed. And so we really saw trucks beginning to bring in enormous amounts of steel as if they were going to construct skyscrapers. So to an architect, that's inherently interesting. What's going on here? And then we started to examine more and study and just observe the construction of the wall and see witness its effects on the landscape, on the people and cities and towns. And so that's sort of how this book began.
And I'm reminded by the book, too, that while there is a long stretch, obviously several long stretches, where there is pretty much just desolation on either side of the border, there are also places where there are thriving communities on both sides of this. So it's not just the very, very tippy end of the United States and the very, very beginning of Mexico or vice versa. I mean, in some cases, there are living, thriving communities butt up against each other on either side of this barrier.
Right. There are several sister cities that the wall divides. We can think about, for example, the most famous one, Tijuana and San Diego, for example, is one example of where a wall cuts right through the city. And on the Tijuana side, the houses just butt up right against the wall, so there's a very dense urban fabric on one side just pushing against the border.
You're not the only voice in the book. My eyebrows went up when I saw Ted Cruz, but then I noticed it's Teddy Cruz.
Yeah.
Who are the other contributors?
The other contributors are Michael Deere, Norma Iglesias Prieto, Marcelo DiCintio. And so these are experts who've written many books about the border and the border wall. And so I asked them to contribute some thoughts based on our differing perspectives about what's happening with the border wall.
There are thoughts, there are maps, there are renderings of potential uses for the border wall, some of them completely serious, some of them completely whimsical, like the Border game, which looks like a board game with the wall right in the middle. And there's all sorts of other stuff to talk about with Ronald Rael. His book is called Border Wall as Architecture. You heard about who the other contributors are there as well. It's a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary. It does predate, most of these ideas do predate the Donald Trump campaign and the vision for the newer, bigger wall. We'll come back and talk more with Ronald and take phone calls and emails from you when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Ronald Rael, artist, architect, and activist. Everything starts with an A for Ronald Rael. He is a professor at the University of California, Berkeley, and is actually stationed in two departments, the architecture and art practice. And he is the creator, not just the only author, because there are other contributors as well, of a book considering the border between the United States and Mexico and what could be done other than just keeping people out or in his book, Border Wall as Architecture, a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Chantal Mouffe, in the foreword of the book, says the wall can be a pedagogical tool. So to teach what to whom?
All right, that's a great question. Well, I think that it can teach a lot of things, and in fact, that's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. I think that the existing wall has taught us that maybe it doesn't work so well, that when you build something like locations, it has the potential to bring people together and not necessarily keep them apart. And I also think it has the ability to serve as a kind of opportunity that... Are you still there, Jeffrey?
Yeah, we're still here. We heard some clicks, but you're fine.
Okay. Well, I think it has the opportunity to serve as a kind of infrastructure, let's say. And I say that with some hesitation, but I'm of the mindset that architects can't ignore what's in the landscape. We can't think of a landscape as a clean slate that we just go in and do something without considering the context. And so one thing that architects have to do now is consider this context, and the wall is part of it. And I'm criticized often about thinking, well, why does the wall have to be part of the context? But I think it's important to recognize that the wall has created a scar in the landscape, and we as designers have to deal with that scar.
It's interesting, though, that where other people see a wall as a separator, you see it potentially as a combiner, though, too.
Well, I think that's what has been happening. And in the book, I tell stories about binational yoga classes, binational volleyball games, binational horse races, and then I speculate on binational theaters and binational libraries and teeter-totters and parks with swings that swing from both sides, just to further demonstrate maybe the ridiculousness of the wall, but also to speak to its potential as a way of building on or alongside the wall as a way to dismantle it. Because I want to remind everyone that this is a wall, this is a book about a protest, but it's not one that ignores the existing wall. It's not one that's making propositions for new walls. It's saying the wall has taught us lessons about what a wall does in the landscape, but also maybe we have to go back and reflect upon what was constructed and attempt to react to it, attempt to fix it maybe.
So, I mean, if you had your druthers, you got to be king of the world for a few days, would you insist upon no wall at all?
I believe so, but I think that I want to take that one step further because I've found it very interesting in some places where maybe the material of the wall that exists could be useful in some places. And I want to point to one particular story that I tell, which is about an art installation by the Mexican artist who's based in San Francisco, Ana Teresa Fernandez. And she does this beautiful installation on the wall where she paints the wall a color that matches the sky. She calls this project Erasing the Wall. And by painting the wall blue, it makes for a really stunning effect, which looks like she has actually erased the wall, that it doesn't exist there anymore. It's like a hole has opened up magically. And the story that I tell talks about how the people on the Tijuana side have really taken ownership and pride in this installation. And so they don't allow anyone to graffiti over it or to damage it in any way. And I wonder and speculate about the moments that, let's say if there was a president who came along and said, we must tear down this wall. I wonder if that section of the wall might be preserved to remember how that wall brought people together and opened the minds of people. So I think there are places along the border where building and investment in design are important. And I'm only speculating, could the material infrastructure that exists now be useful in a post-border wall world? And so these are the kinds of complex questions that I like to ask myself and speculate on in the book.
So ways in which portions of the wall could be deployed for something else?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Could it serve as a hot water generation infrastructure to provide hot water to clinics or serve as an armature for clean water filtration or photovoltaic energy? So can we begin to rethink what it is now in its existing state and apply other uses? And I ask that question because I think we have to, I think that what I'm trying to do is ask questions about how we can in some way transform its meaning and in that way conceptually dismantle it and ultimately physically dismantle it.
Ronald Rail's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book with several other contributors is called Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. Let's take a call here. We have John and Grants Pass on the line. Thank you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. Questions? Realistically, is this going to really happen? I guess my question would be, what does the Trump administration have to do to actually pull this off? And then for those of us who think this is a really stupid idea, what do we have to do? And then second is, it seems like if they build this wall, people are going to figure out a way to blow a hole in it or something anyway. And so is that realistically going to happen? Thanks.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Appreciate it. So, you're generally casting your look to what exists there now, but what do you think about the ideas for the bigger, more comprehensive wall that Donald Trump is talking about?
Well, I think that there's a couple of ways that I can answer a lot of those points that John brings up. The Trump administration campaigned on a promise to build a wall. And just even in that sentence, it suggests that no wall exists now, right? When Trump stood up before audiences and said, I'm going to build a wall, and everybody cheered, there was clearly an ignorance that 650 miles of wall didn't already exist, but it does. And what we've seen now are photos emerging that demonstrate, well, this is, look what we're doing. And they show photos of the existing wall to suggest that, oh, finally, they're building the wall. But in fact, this is wall construction that has been ongoing for decades, that has gone through Democratic administrations and Republican administrations. It really ramped up during the George Bush administration, of course, but it continued in the Obama administration. And It's continuing and ongoing now. And I don't know when and if it will stop, but I think that we have to call to attention that a border wall, that one-third of the border is now walled off. And I think that's something that people don't realize, and that's one of the reasons also that I wrote this book, because I think it was important to understand the wall that already exists and its consequences on the environment and the landscape and the people.
Mm-hmm. And what do you say to the people, though, who say we have to secure our borders somehow?
Well, I'm not an opponent of security, certainly, but I also think we have to recognize how the wall has performed in its existing state, or not performed. It's very easy to cross. Even Border Patrol and Homeland Security see it as a 5-minute barrier. They have done a series of studies, some mathematical studies that they call border calculus, that demonstrate if there's a 5-minute barrier in place, then that improves the chances of Border Patrol capturing someone entering the United States illegally. So it's a 5-minute barrier, and it's a tremendous amount of money to spend on a 5-minute barrier. And so these are the kind of questions that I think we have to reconcile with. Is it really worth it, especially at the cost of taxpayer money and the cost of human lives, because the border wall pushes people to further extremes in the desert? Is this something that is worth it, or are there other ways to promote security and safety along the border?
In fact, you have a couple people in the book referring to it as a speed bump, really, isn't it?
Right. It has been considered simply a speed bump. And Homeland Security, in fact, considers natural barriers to be speed bumps as well, like rivers. And there are many stretches along the U.S.-Mexico border where the river stops flowing for various environmental reasons. So would it be better to invest in money to promote the health of riparian landscapes and rivers than build a wall? These are, again, the kinds of questions that I speculate on and wonder about.
Ronald Riehl's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, artist, architect, and activist in the Bay Area with two positions in the University of California, Berkeley. His book is called Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. A lot of the ideas in the book focus on existing barriers between the United States and Mexico and not focused quite so much on the proposed Donald Trump wall. You can join the conversation on the Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. In fact, there was you had an entry in a design competition around the time of the economic stimulus with border wall as infrastructure that pretty much set a pattern for what appears here.
Right. Many of these ideas came from that competition, and some of the more, actually, many of the both whimsical and pragmatic suggestions for building alongside the wall came from that competition. And at that time, I mean, I really think that the ways we've thought about the wall have changed over the course of the evolution of the wall. I mean, at that time, very little new wall as part of the Secure Fence Act of 2006 had been constructed. And so we went to Washington with a series of proposals that say, hey, if you're going to build this wall, it's going to cause a lot of problems and a lot of damage. Maybe you should consider these types of suggestions alongside the wall to ameliorate the effects of what this wall is going to cause, the effects that the wall is going to have on the environment and people. So that's where we went in the beginning. And as the research continued, we began to think about ways that, again, how, as we saw, for example, the wall beginning to affect wildlife, or how we saw people come together along the wall, are these moments that we could institutionalize to draw attention to the wall? In other words, Friendship Park for a very long time was a place where people came together.
In San Diego and Tijuana.
In San Diego and Tijuana. And there was even a point at the when Friendship Park was first created that Pat Nixon, then President Nixon's wife, came to inaugurate Friendship Park, and there was just a barbed wire fence there. And so she had her security cut down the barbed wire fence because she didn't want it as part of this inauguration. And she was quoted as saying, well, I hope this fence doesn't exist here very long. And then it became the most kind of militarized and fortified wall along the U.S.-Mexico border.
You mentioned in here, too, that the wall at some point devised a university campus?
There were proposals by the Army Corps of Engineers to cut the University of Brownsville, Texas, in half with the construction of a wall. And this was battled for many years. But the resolution was that there was a gate and a kind of fence surrounding a golf course that was along the river. And so where the negotiation was that they would embolster that fence that surrounded the golf course to create a kind of wall there, and they would, Homeland Security would provide funding for security research to the university. And so that's what happened, and now the golf course is walled off, thereby putting that golf course on the Mexican side of the wall. And that golf course was traditionally a place where Mexican-Americans could play golf because they weren't allowed in other golf courses. But because of the wall, people stopped going to this golf course and eventually closed down. And so now this golf course lies defunct on the Mexican side of the wall next to the University of Texas Brownsville campus.
Well, and this whole region, I mean, we were talking about the human impacts, but to get us back to the environmental sorts of impacts, the fact is that Brownsville's on the Rio Grande. The Rio Grande, I'm looking at a map of it right now, it wiggles all over the place, which has been one of the discussions of the concept of any kind of semi-permanent barrier in a place where a river is going to meander, which is what rivers do.
Yes, and that's what makes it very difficult to construct a wall along the border, because the river meanders back and forth, and so it forces the Army Corps of Engineers to construct the wall deep into the United States, often up to 3 miles into the United States. So you can imagine the amount of land that lays fallow or inaccessible on the southern side of that wall. And so there's a lot of private property and farms, and so in many cases, people have to check in at enormous steel gates with a code, and the gates open up and they cross over the wall to access the property.
Yeah, I've heard a fair number of, there's a fair argument within Texas itself about where any barriers should be built and whether they should be built.
Right. And there are some cases, and I point out in my book, that even ranchers and farmers build ladders over their fences just so they can allow human traffic to pass through without damaging their fences.
Wow. The book is called Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. Ronald Rail put it together with several other contributors. Want to ask, we were talking about materials involved in the wall now, and you were talking about ways in which those materials could be used for different purposes and maybe even demonstrated now while the wall still stands. But let's talk about the materials that actually have gone to the wall, because that there's already some repurposing involved there that I didn't realize, where structures from elsewhere have been used to help build the barrier.
Right. Well, in addition to new walls being made out of concrete and steel, there are walls that have been constructed out of repurposed Vietnam-era landing mats, where helicopters would land on in soft, like marsh areas during Vietnam. And in some cases, some walls are made out of recycled railroad tracks.
All right, so all kinds of materials in there. And was something called Fence Lab for a while, though, too, that you point out in the book.
Yeah, Fence Lab is interesting because this is the place where the wall was designed, part of Sandia National Laboratories. And so they would test the impenetrability of walls by loading up trucks with several tons and slamming into the walls, traveling at 40 miles per hour, these vehicles, and to show how strong these walls were. But there are many cases where, on the other side, the kind of research that's being done is to create a kind of border wall bridges where a couple of tracks are laid out over the wall itself, and vehicles drive right over the walls, in some cases walls that are 16 feet high. In other cases, there are vehicles that have deployable and unfolding bridges that allow cars to drive right over the wall. So I think there's always this is kind of an arms race of walls, where you build a wall and then someone builds a reaction to that wall, and there's always ways to go over and under and through the wall, and they'll, as long as there's a need to move across this landscape, and there always has been a need to move across the landscape, and there always will be, people, water, language, food, culture. These are all the kinds of things that migrate back and forth across the borderlands. It's very hard. We were talking about the rivers shifting. There are many other kinds of phenomena that shift across borders, and to build a barrier that suggests we can stop any and all things from coming across is nearly impossible.
Which gets us back to the description of any barrier as a speed bump. It'll just slow people down. It won't stop them completely. We're talking to Ronald Rael about Border Wall as Architecture, a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary. You're welcome to join the discussion by phone or by email, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. We'll come back and talk more with Ronald and take phone calls and emails from you when we return in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're continuing our discussion with Ronald Rael about the barrier at the U.S.-Mexican border. He explores it from his position as artist, architect, and activist, not a fan of the existing barriers, not a fan of the ideas of Donald Trump to make an even more formidable barrier there. Ronald Rael's book, with his own input and ideas from a lot of other contributors, is called Border Wall as Architecture, a manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico boundary, a way to look at ways that are both serious and whimsical about what to do with the structures that are there and how to not necessarily always separate people, but perhaps combine them as well. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Mark in Redding. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ronald Rael.
Good morning.
Hi.
Great Wall of China was much better keeping the Chinese in than it was keeping invaders out. And in the poem that everyone quotes, the phrase, good fences make good neighbors, there are also multiple times in the same poem that it says, something there is that doesn't like a wall.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well observed, Mark. Appreciate that. And in fact, the Robert Frost is mentioned very early in this book, and I have to put you in that category of something there is that doesn't love a wall.
Right. And I think that poem is often misunderstood as being a poem that's an advocate for walls. But I think there's the recognition in that poem that the person who's creating that wall is really creating deep sighs and kind of not so much appreciating the wall itself. And so this is where this line in the poem, something there is that doesn't love a wall, comes around, where even though we recognize that walls may need to exist in some cases, that we really don't love them or appreciate them. And I think there's ways to rethink them. There's another famous quote by an architect, Hassan Fathi, who's an Egyptian architect. And I know of his work because he was very much an earth builder in making buildings out of adobe in Egypt. But he had a quote that says, architects do not design walls, they design the spaces between them. And this has always been an influential quote to me. And this is basically the way I approach thinking about the wall, that we shouldn't think about the wall itself. We should think about the spaces around the wall and what's happening in those spaces and to learn from those conditions. And so when we see that the wall is serving as a barrier for natural rainfall and finding it either knock down the wall itself because the wall wasn't designed to allow water to flow through it, or that it diverts waters to small towns and floods it, then we realize, oh, well, there is something about this wall that's not well considered, and we should think about the things around the wall, the way that drainages work, the way that animals migrate to access food and water, and we should think about where the wall is being built and cut through. And there's several examples where the wall is dividing or cutting through some very fragile and important natural and cultural landscapes.
Well, and there is one example in here, and I can't quite tell if it's meant seriously or not, but it's the idea of using organ pipe cactus as a wall.
Yes. Well, that's That's a very controversial one, because I think there's a misunderstanding of that drawing that I did of Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument, which is, I'll explain it because it's a little bit difficult, but when the Organ Pipe National Monument is a wilderness, which means that no motorized vehicles are allowed in that wilderness.
Except
Border Patrol agents. There are a few roads to access that for tourists and visitors, but Border Patrol agents can patrol on certain designated roads, and of course, in the area that the border wall was built, there's an enormous kind of freeway of moving up and down of Border Patrol vehicles where they drag tires and basically smooth out the landscape and keep it completely void of any kind of plant growth. Well, this was very rich and fragile landscape, and when the wall was constructed, it actually increased the amount of pedestrian and vehicle roads that were cutting through the park, because people were still driving across, finding ways through, walking across, and then Border Patrol agents, because they have permission to drive off-road if there is some suggestion of someone entering illegally, so they would then drive through this landscape, and then all-terrain vehicles, and so the amount of vehicular traffic cutting through this wilderness increased exponentially after the construction of the wall. So my proposition as a way to repair this landscape is not to invest in more wall construction, but to invest in a replanting of the of all of the vegetation and a restoration of the landscape, of this very delicate landscape that had been destroyed. And so the intention of this drawing that I did, again, these drawings are meant to call out the kind of ridiculous nature of this and how you deal with it, but it was to say, well, let's do some intensive replanting in this wilderness, because this is part of our national heritage. We shouldn't allow national security to destroy our national heritage. I think those things work in opposition, and that's the great irony of the propositions in the book and the stories and just the wall itself.
Well, and in fact, you mentioned the dragging of tires, and this is a part of the book that can really blow your mind, but you compare this to the Zen gardens where you smooth out the sand and leave this fresh new landscape for you to draw on or, you know, squiggle your stuff in.
Well, I find that I always use this term. I say the wall is horrifically beautiful. It's created and grows from violence and maybe xenophobia and so many issues, but yet if you appreciate like some kind of purity, there's something very beautiful about this steel, like almost land art structure moving through the desert. I won't deny it as much as I dislike and loathe its effects. And so in just dealing with these kind of ironies and juxtapositions, I talk about how this smoothing and grading constantly every day, almost all day long with tires of the roads alongside the border is kind of, horrifically beautiful. And it creates this landscape that is completely denuded of any kind of vegetation. Any animals that are there get squashed and crushed over, and there are several endangered species that are really affected by this act. It throws up huge amounts of dust into the air because all the vegetation has been destroyed. And so it's a problem, and this is what we can learn from the 650 miles of wall that already exists and how we might think about what not to do in the future if walls are constructed.
You know, and I think if people open their minds a bit to what's being discussed here, regardless of their feelings about the needs for any kind of a barrier or not, when you say the wall is horrifically beautiful and you see some of these very long shots, you know, shot from a long distance away with a long lens that show the wall, fence, whatever it is at that point, draped across the landscape, if you remember the work of Christo and some of the stuff that he's done over the years with, like, putting a curtain across a valley and stuff like that, there is an analogy there.
Yes, and I draw that analogy, and I think it's deeper than just a visual analogy, because I find Christo's work to be very beautiful as well, as you can imagine. But there was a politic behind that work, and there's a documentary about Running Fence, and of course Running Fence was there in Northern California. Mm-hmm. There's this beautiful documentary where they document the process of getting the approvals for the construction of this fence through the various private properties in Northern California. And in one of these town hall meetings, someone says stands up and they don't want this fence built, and they're arguing for it. And Christo makes the point that it's the fence actually isn't the project. It's what's happening here, this political discussion that is the project itself. And I think that part of the reason why I wrote this book is to open up this discussion and to call attention to the wall. And while it may not be enough just to call attention, and I accept that, I think it's important that we can't have the ignorance to not know that the wall already exists. I think we can learn from it, and I think we can actually grow from it.
Well, you know, I would expect no less from an artist and architect that the book is very eye-catching. It's very well designed. But there's a picture here, a two-page spread of a person flying over the wall. What's going on there?
Well, I tell this sort of evolving story about things that go over the wall. And I talk about, of course, people climbing the wall. And then I talk about the catapults and cannons that are used to launch marijuana over the wall. And they've been discovered by Homeland Security and also by Mexican authorities. And in the Middle Ages, they used trebuchets to destroy wall fortifications around cities, but they also often launched bodies over the wall, dead bodies that were diseased. As a sort of form of early chemical warfare, let's call it. But there has been speculation that humans are launched over the wall as a form of immigration. And there's been no evidence that that has actually occurred, but there's a television show, Mythbusters, that tested that, and they launched a body some 200 feet over a wall to see if they could do so safely. And they said, well, maybe it wasn't able to be done safely, but it certainly could be possible. But there was an event that took place in Tijuana where a gentleman who held the record for being a human cannonball who's been launched the furthest took it upon himself during this event to be launched over the U.S.-Mexico border wall. And he did this with the permission of Border Patrol. So he had to hold his passport while he was launched over, and he landed in a net in the San Diego side, and then Border Patrol agents verified his passport, and that's how he sort of immigrated, if you will, into the United States. And so that is wrought with all kinds of ironies and ridiculousness and These are the kinds of stories of the wall that, again, there was an enormous crowds and audiences on both sides that witnessed that event of a kind of launching over the wall.
Let's take a call here. We have Don and Ashland on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Ronald Rayl, the author of Border Wall as Architecture.
Hi. When I hear about the concept of the wall, I think about the one that was built between East and West Germany back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And how there was great fanfare with a little over a generation later when it was torn down again. And I was thinking about if we have a an extensive border wall, will we have someday a similar scene as the United States becomes more diversified and the younger people tend to be more progressive and open-minded? Have you contemplated that eventuality, say, in a generation or two?
All right. Thanks for the thoughts, Don. Appreciate that. What do you say, Ronald?
Sure. Well, actually, I hope this book encourages that, is my aspiration for the book, that it really pushes towards a post-border wall world, and that from the design perspective, from an architect's perspective, we have to plan for that. I think that from an architect's point of view, we could say, well, if we believe this, we'd say, tear down this wall, and I believe that. I'm on that side of the fence, if you will. But I think that we also have the responsibility to think about what comes next. And this is why I suggest places where this kind of tearing down or dismantling of the wall is replaced with something else, or where the material infrastructure that exists could be used for something else. And so this is the way I'm thinking about it. And if you think about the Berlin Wall, when the wall was torn down, that landscape became a landscape in which designers had to work in. And in some cases, it became parks because it was not accessed for a long time, and wildlife and trees grew up in it and became very beautiful parks. And in some cases, they memorialized the wall and left sections of it. There are museums alongside. And there's, I think, one of the most beautiful moments is a church called the Chapel of Reconciliation. There was a historic church that existed right within the wall between East and West Germany. And for years, that church was seen as a problem because it was in the way. Gunneries couldn't see people crossing through. They would cross through the church or behind the church because it was a very large object. And eventually, in the 80s, they blew up the church. They destroyed it. And just a few years later, the wall came down. And so this grand historic church that was so important to communities on both sides was destroyed. So a church was built in its place called the Chapel of Reconciliation. And they used some of the debris from the wall, crushed up with clay, to build a rammed earthen church in that location.
Wow, so they took what had been destroyed and used it to rebuild what was destroyed in order to make the other thing that was destroyed be more effective.
Right.
Wow, lots of stuff in this book to think about. The pictures alone will make your jaw drop more than a few times. The book is called Border Wall as Architecture, a Manifesto for the U.S.-Mexico Boundary. Ronald Rael, the principal author of the book. Thanks so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thank you very much, Jeff.
All right, take care.